against animals.
Right.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We are going to move and move expeditiously today because we have floor session at 3 o'clock and we got a late start. So we appreciate everyone's indulgence for our revised schedule. Representative Ackerman,
yes,
you have a motion?
Sure, I do. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2802.
Representative Ackerman moves that the rules be suspended and that we reconsider the vote on House Bill 2802. Is there any discussion? Those are the opinion we should reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2802 was sent to the floor. Those of us who are of the opinion that the rules be suspended for purposes of reconsidering the vote will say aye.
Aye.
Those
aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries and the rules have been suspended. Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2802 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves that we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2802 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion to your motion. Here's the issue. We have a fiscal on this that we did not know about. This was the arson bill, colleagues. The fiscal is under your agenda. It's the first item under your agenda. It shows an 03-05 fiscal impact of $85,000. And in the 05-07, it shows a $400,844 fiscal impact. So it would be the chair's intent to assuming that the members agree to reconsider the vote, that we then, once the vote has been reconsidered, amend our motion and move it to the Committee on Ways and Means. So I want to make sure, I've got to go through the script here. Do you have a question, Representative Anderson, before I move on?
After your
okay, thing. Why don't we do this then? Those are the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2802 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. We'll say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed, no. All right. The motion carries and the vote has been reconsidered. Representative Anderson.
Well, $85,000 is a lot of money in this biennium, but we just had a nursing home and a future nursing home that was just in construction raised to the ground by fire by an arsonist. Hmm. We've had about two lumber yards, one paint store, McDonald's, and one other that I can't remember over the last 5 years or so in Grants Pass where it really is a major problem, and any help that we could get in deterring arson would certainly be beneficial in our community, and I suspect in many around the state. Is the limit 50,000? Is that essentially what we've been asked to?
Yeah, the guideline is anything over 50,000 in the 03-05 biennium we've been asked to send to the Ways and Means Committee. And Representative Anderson, I couldn't agree with you more. Particularly disappointing is the fact that the parties, the criminal defense lawyers, the DAs, the folks from the Fire Chiefs Association, everybody else had come to an agreement on this bill. And so it, eventually got to the point that I think everybody was happy with the version that it was in, and then we were surprised with the impact. And obviously it's because of the enhancements to the degrees of the penalty which we created. What I will tell you, Representative Anderson, is I'm certainly going to indicate in transference of the bill to the Ways and Means Committee that I would like, to the extent possible, that they make this a matter of consideration in the Ways and Means Committee as they're looking at those resources. The flip side is we all know, given the situation that we're in, that we can't prosecute most of the crimes we've currently got on the books. And say most is probably wrong. There are a lot of serious crimes right now that we are not prosecuting because of our lack of available resources. So, I'm hopeful that we can, make something happen, but I'm not overly optimistic, and I guess that's the way I'd leave it.
Is there a way in which a bill like this can be underfunded temporarily, and then as revenues come in, that it could later be funded at the level to which it's expected?
Well, it's always possible to stick a provision on the bill that sets it out into the future and says, effective on the last day of the 03-05 biennium, the bill becomes operative, and that does happen in this process sometimes. And so you force forward the fiscal impact. Mm-hmm. We're trying harder in this modern day of trying to manage these budgets to do that as little as possible, because what you end up doing is you end up sticking an upcoming legislative assembly with a budget problem that they're going to have to deal with that we created. And so it is, you know, the new watchword is as much as possible, pay as you go. And I don't think that's an inappropriate position for us to take.
And pre-file next year.
Well, right. I want to say that I don't think that we're necessarily assigning this bill to its fate. The people who support this bill and work hard on it, they're effective, and they're going to continue to do the kind of work that they're going to try to do in the Ways and Means Committee. And obviously, Representative Anderson, with your personal experience in Grants Pass, you'd be a great person for them to recruit to assist them in their discussions with the Ways and Means Committee. Anything else? All right, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2802 be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Ackerman moves that House Bill 2802 be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion on that motion? Those of the opinion that 2802 be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means will say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. All right. Motion carries, and because it's going to Ways and Means, we won't need a carrier on the bill. All right. Now we're going to go to a work session on House Bill 2074. Council.
Dear members of the committee, House Bill 2074 requires the Public Service Commission to submit biennial report to the legislature. Allows senior judges to serve in the commission and prohibits a person who is primarily engaged in providing public services from serving. We also have two sets of amendments before you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I would suggest that maybe Ann Christian come up. One set of the amendments is a provision that would clarify, and Peter Ozan also, the public services executive director denies in whole and part of fees paid, expenses submitted, then the presiding judge shall review that, and that's, I think, for the technical reason, the need to have some kind of judicial review of administrative decision. And it also says that once the presiding judge or designee, their order is final. Then you have the -4 amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and these are in response to the overview hearings that we did as it relates to extraordinary expenses and directing your attention to page 2. First off, we had a question about expert witnesses, out-of-state expert witnesses, and this is contracting with expert witnesses to allow contracting with out-of-state expert witnesses only if in-state expert witnesses are not available. And then going down to line 24, establish peer review system for approval of non-routine fees and expenses incurred in cases involving aggravated murder and the crimes listed in 137.700 and 137.707. I believe that's measure 11. I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we heard a substantial amount of testimony concerning disagreements over expenditures in this area where district attorneys contended they were not needed and defense counsel contended they were. As you know, in aggravated murder cases, they can be very expensive. A lot of experts are brought in, and if you don't do it right, the courts look at these cases very closely, and you can have to start all over again. Then starting in line 29, establish a complaint process that allows district attorneys, criminal defense counsel, and the public to file complaints concerning payments from public funds or non-routine fees and expenses incurred in cases. That was another suggestion that we heard from District Attorney Harker Road from Lane County. And going over to page 7, notwithstanding subsection 8 of the section, the total amount of monies is determined to be necessary and reasonable for non-routine fees and expenses may be disclosed to the district attorney at the conclusion of the trial in circuit court. You may remember discussions about that they could not get the expenditures right away because the case was in appeal. Now, this does not allow a breakdown of the expenditure. So, for example, if defense counsel were to retain a psychologist for a particular aspect of the case, and the psychologist had a particular subset expertise, they would not necessarily get that information. And the reason for that is there's a Court of Appeals case which did not allow disclosure when it was at issue because of due process considerations, in the sense that if the case were overturned and you had to go back and try the case in circuit court again, that could give away the strategy of defense counsel in that situation. Then going over to page 8, this is an issue that we did not have before us, but because we were talking about extraordinary expenditures, but it was raised during the meeting and at other times. Neither the Court of Appeals nor the Supreme Court may substitute one appointed counsel for another of this subsection except pursuant to policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines of the Public Defense Services Commission. We have a similar provision in here for circuit court appointments, and that's over in page 11. And what it happens in many cases, in some cases, an individual may decide that for whatever reason they don't like the attorney that they have, and then insist upon another one and make it almost impossible for the attorney to represent that person. I even heard one story of where the defendant punched his attorney in the nose. And there are individuals, we've received an email, especially I think out of Portland, where one person who I understand may have had some mental difficulties went through 8 counsel. And this would allow the Public Defense Services Commission to set rules and regulations on that. It's difficult in statute to try to do that, and they are better suited probably than we are, because there may be circumstances, even when it's third or fourth counsel, where you may have to appoint an additional counsel. For example, the fourth one dies. Or
right. Okay. Colleagues, this is, as you'll recall, early in the session, our work on the indigent defense-related issues, and then we circulated the report, and I got comments back from you, which report was eventually forwarded in final form to the chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee and the two co-chairs and the speaker and the Senate president about our sort of efforts to discuss at least the issues of extraordinary expenses in the committee and what our process and conclusions were, along with recommendations. And 2074, the dash fours, are essentially the sort of work product of the recommendations that were in that report to address some of the issues and to do it in a manner that allows the new Public Defense Services Commission to implement these procedures as they come on board, and to address at least some of the perceived concerns about extraordinary expenses. And so with that, I invite the comments of both Christian and Peter Ozan, and whoever wants to lead off. Or if neither of you do, then I'll just let the committee ask you questions. But Peter, if you've got some comments, we'd be pleased to receive them.
For the record, Peter Ozan, Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. Well, we worked with the committee, and we think these are appropriate changes and ones that we certainly are happy to respond to in terms of deliberating about the substantive issues and promulgating procedures to guide this area of public defense. We're very concerned to ensure that the process has credibility, and so we think this will do it. So we're certainly very comfortable with these amendments.
And I just want to put on the record, I've had several of the board members of the new Public Defense Services Commission that have approached me and have said, would be pleased to, some of these things we would have done and would do and will do on our own by rule. And I take them at their word for that they would, in fact, do that. What I think is important, however, is that, and I don't think it limits the Public Defense Services Commission by moving this legislation forward. This allows them, it essentially says the legislature is going to require that you do this stuff, but allows them the flexibility to adopt a rule and to go through a rulemaking process where there will be input, public input, including input from district attorneys and others into that process as to how that rule gets constructed. But it didn't seem appropriate, I thought, for us as they're starting out in this new transition from the Indigent Defense Services Division, to hamstring them with a bunch of detailed direction. I think we're making the legislative intent here pretty clear. We want these issues to be addressed in a manner by rule that appropriately responds to concerns that were raised at the hearing. And at the same time, you know, give them the flexibility as the commission appointed to oversee this, to adopt those rules. And I think 2074-4 amendments strike that balance. And I hope that I'm not putting words in your mouth, that you think it strikes the balance as well.
I think so, Mr. Chair of the committee. And I can assure you personally that we're wise enough to know where the complaints came from in large part, so we'll include those folks in a work study, a work group process. We want to have our colleagues in the prosecution bar participating so that we're all comfortable with the procedures and rules that we develop. So.
Great. You went over the dash fours pretty in detail, Mr. Taylor. Can you just remind us again what the dash threes accomplish?
Sure, members of the committee. I think, and Christian could probably better explain. I've got a pretty decent idea, but she's even more familiar.
All right, Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ann Christian, Director of Indigent Defense Services, and I would characterize the dash three amendments as additional housekeeping amendments that the commission is requesting the committee approve. House Bill 2074 in its original form, in fact, was the Commission's housekeeping bill. And since the hearing that we had on that bill in January, a couple of issues have come up. And I've provided to the committee both a hand-engrossed version of original 2074 as well as just a one-page summary of what both the Dash 3 amendments and Dash 4 amendments do. First, Legislative Counsel Virginia Vanderbilt, in the course of drafting the bill that addresses a juvenile psychiatric security review board, identified the fact that current law does not provide for appointment of counsel in psychiatric security review boards, which was an oversight from 1991, so we took the opportunity to correct that oversight in current law. The second of four things. At the conclusion of the hearing in January, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jim Nass, who is counsel to the Supreme Court, expressed a concern about the fact that under the structure for the commission as written at that point in time, there was no opportunity for a judge to review adverse decisions against indigent defense attorneys as far as their billings. And so the housekeeping bills and housekeeping amendments in Dash 3 include provisions for judicial review when an administrative authority with the Office of Public Defense Services disallows all or part of an attorney's bill. They will have an avenue to seek judicial review. The third is the Dash 3 amendments would amend the point in time when attorneys who are appointed in appellate cases can submit a bill. Current law requires the attorney to wait until oral argument. People who are familiar with appellate law know that that often can be a matter of a year or so, that we're asking attorneys to wait for payment. And this was a suggestion, excuse me, from one of our excellent attorneys who continue to do criminal appeals, who used to be at the Office of Public Defense Services. He recognized the need to have a length of time before an attorney can bill, and he suggested and incorporated in the Dash 3 amendments is that an attorney could submit a bill at the point at which they complete the brief. Most of the work that an attorney is going to do in an appeal is completed with submission of the brief other than oral argument. And the final thing is a deletion and a reference to the Commission and the Office of Public Defense Services employees that deletes a statutory requirement that the Commission will be considering for an adoption under their personnel rules, which they are required to adopt and are working on as we speak.
Okay. Quick questions, Representative Jensen?
I want to go back to four, so let me wait till you get through with three.
Oh, you want to go back to four? Okay. Are there any questions on the Dash 3 amendments? Okay. Thank you, Ann. Now, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the cap I on
Section 42 in the dash 4 amendments, page 2. Contracting with expert witnesses to allow contracting with out-of-state expert witness only if in-state expert witnesses are not available. Excuse the sensitivity here to Eastern Oregon, but you understand that this would cost us probably more money than if we were able to get expert witnesses from the Tri-City area or from the Boise area, depending on which part of Eastern Oregon or Northeastern Oregon we were from. I'm sure this was not the intention to cost us more money. The intention was to try to save money. So I would like to suggest some kind of an amendment or something there that would clarify that so that we wouldn't be stuck in having to go to Portland and paying transportation it's the better part of $250 by air from Portland to Pendleton on the puddle jumper that flies in there, and it'd be even more to get to Ontario because there isn't any way to get to Ontario from Portland. That's
expensive.
Good point.
What?
Measure 11 will get you.
I beg your pardon. I've been corrected. Measure 11, I understand, will get you to Ontario.
That is
true. It'll get you to Pendleton, too.
Yeah, that's right. There's a place in Pendleton that'll get you, won't it? Representative Anderson, you wanted to make a comment.
Did you want to discuss that point at all?
Did you have a different point you wanted to go to? Yeah, I think... You know, there's probably a way we could do this conceptually right now. The other way to do this would be to just say we're going to pick up the amendment on the Senate side. I don't disagree with you at all, Representative Jensen, that, obviously if you've got somebody across the river in Pasco who can come down and testify and your Oregon witness is down in Roseburg, you're going to be better off to pull that person in from Washington to do that work. I think because we're talking about primarily these aggravated murder cases and the Measure 11 level cases, by and large, the kind of experts that we're talking about hiring in Ann could probably tell me it's probably not a perfect statement, but by and large, you may have trouble finding them in Pasco or in Boise anyway, and they may need to be coming from someplace otherwise out of state if there isn't an in-state person to do it. But I have no objection fundamentally to your requested change. I think it makes sense. One of the ways to do it would simply say out-of-state expert witnesses only if in-state witnesses are not available or less expensive. I mean, you could make it that simple of a change.
I think you'd have to be careful there, Mr. Chair, because somebody could be cheaper. Not they also want to keep the quality up. I mean, if you want somebody in Pasco lowballing everybody just to get the job, but he's not the best person.
Well, and that's so let's kick it around a little bit more while we're here thinking about it, because I've got another question for Ann, but let's go ahead and let Representative Anderson, and we'll find a way to address the concern that you've raised, Representative Jensen. Representative Anderson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question relating to page 2 in dash 4 on line 27. The review shall be conducted by a panel of attorneys who practice in the area of criminal defense. It's my assumption that that rules out the prosecutors or DAs, that they would not be included to bring some balance to this peer review.
Counsel, do you want to?
Chairman of the committee, Representative Anderson, I think if you had district attorneys on here, you would start to raise constitutional questions. In the sense that you have someone who's on the prosecution side reviewing and making decisions that's on the defense side.
Is this pre-trial or is this post-trial?
This is someone who's probably being tried for murder.
It's ongoing, Representative Anderson. It's so essentially what happens is somebody says, I need a witness in this case, to an expert to testify on this issue, and that'll go up. And if it gets into this review process, there will be a peer review system of other defense lawyers who have tried similar kinds of cases who can say, we think that that's request is, sort of above the mark, or we think, given the nature of this kind of a case, that that's an appropriate request. You can't have in that role someone who represents the state as a district attorney or an assistant district attorney sitting in judgment on that kind of a decision without getting into constitutional problems. So the concept of peer review is to have other lawyers not involved in this case but who have had practice experience in this area to weigh in and make a determination as to whether or not it is or it isn't a balanced request. That's the
And Mr. Chair, those attorneys will be carefully picked by the commission as far as who they are. They will indeed be very experienced attorneys who I consult with on a number of occasions in my role in looking at extraordinary expenses for two purposes primarily, whether or not the services is actually reasonable and necessary, and alternatives. Frequently, experienced defense attorneys have over the years figured out better ways to do things less expensively, so there's a real resource out there with some of these experienced attorneys.
Okay, further questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I have just maybe two or three. Relating to the dash four amendments on page, last line on page two, commission would have the authority to allow the public to file complaints. I'm wondering what the rationale is for that, and is that going to involve more work than necessary, and what right does the public have to see these documents at any time? I just need the rationale for that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, I'll let...
I'm not sure they love that language either.
No, we're cooperating with the committee, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, so I...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that was a suggestion that we received from Mr. Harkerod when we ran these issues, the report by him, and for his input, the feeling that if you're going to have a complaint process, then it shouldn't be just limited to district attorneys and criminal defense counsel. It's obviously a policy issue, so...
Well, my sense is that frankly, to the extent that this is a public system and this is a system of public defense, that the commission is a commission that operates under appointment with legislative authorization and subject to open meetings laws and public records laws, that if a member of the public thinks that they want to issue a complaint in this process, they don't like something that was done in a trial that they were following, I think that actually this is a helpful idea. I think it gets them educated. It keeps the Public Defense Services Commission not only in connection with both the criminal defense and the prosecution community, but it also connects them in a way with the public in a process that doesn't generally exist right now. So I guess I don't see it as a problem. I don't think there are going to be a lot of them, but I will. But to the extent that there are complaints filed, and this is a repository for some of those complaints, I think it's an appropriate way to start dealing right now with the complaints that just sort of percolate out there that people want to, you know, email or write you or I an email about something they saw on TV or didn't like or don't know very much about, and here's a home where they can get somebody to actually respond to them with some actual information about why this was done. So I don't view it as either a problematic issue or one that the commission ought to feel in the least degree threatened by.
Right, Mr. Chair, committee members. Yeah, this is something I think Ann can speak to, doing this already. Maybe the terminology of file complaint sounds a bit formal. We certainly would, as the chair recognizes, take an opportunity where the public had a question. It most likely be the public media representative, but whether it was just a private citizen, we would respond and explain what we want to do, take the opportunity to explain it. So we'd be doing this without that provision, certainly.
And Mr. Chair, real quickly, I appreciate Representative Ackerman's concern about the workload. And we currently, the division that I direct, we currently do receive complaints from inmates, clients, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, and others, and we do address those complaints. I kind of like this in a way because one of the things I have found frustrating is that if there is, I'll give you an example, a problem in a certain county where the district attorney contacts someone else about the problem and I hear about it a year later, I think it's good to have a formal, structured complaint process, especially with the courts moving out of the indigent defense business, so that we can better say to individuals, if you have a complaint, this is the place to file that complaint as opposed to learning about it third hand a year later. So I'm very comfortable with it.
I have a couple more questions.
Yes, Representative Ackerman.
This would, and I'm satisfied with your answer because I understand that you have the authority to adopt policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines to control this, and that does satisfy me. I'm wondering, however, though, that if the public has a right to file a complaint, that implies it has a right to full disclosure. And is it possible the public would get disclosure of this information before it would be discoverable by the district attorney?
Mr. Chair, I believe not. Under both the proposed amendment that limits disclosure to at the conclusion of the case, limits disclosure to the district attorney, and limits disclosure to the total amount expended in the case, backed up with the case that counsel referenced, State versus Bradley Cunningham from Washington County. It's a Court of Appeals case.
Let me have just two more, and then I'll...
You may.
But suppose somebody files a public records request, what would happen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, we have had those occur. We have received public records requests in the early 90s, and the Attorney General's office assisted us in representation. That was prior to the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Bradley Cunningham, and the Attorney General's office issued an opinion that indicated that those records were in fact not public up until the point at which the trial level case was completed. Since that time, we do have the Court of Appeals, I think, very clear decision on that matter, and would help us in asserting that the records are confidential under public records law.
Okay, may I have one more. Again, on the dash fours page, the bottom of page six, top of page five, starting at the bottom of page six, disclosure goes to the DA, not prior to the conclusion of a case, and then in the bold face on page seven, section nine, disclosure is made at the conclusion of the trial in circuit court. I don't see any symmetry between those two, because it's likely that merely at the conclusion of a trial, there could be a retrial on a motion for a new trial, and there could be a retrial on a remand after the appellate process. So are we making the disclosure too soon, or should we change the later language to make it later?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, my division's current procedure is at the end of the trial level case, if the press or a district attorney requests the total amount, we do disclose it. The defense attorneys who I have consulted in that regard don't particularly like that. Many of them don't. But they've never been able to assert, at least in my estimation, an adequate grounds that just disclosing the total amount prejudices their clients.
It's not a line-by-line billing to say how the money was spent. It's essentially those. It's essentially the same thing that you had showed us earlier, a chart that just identifies the expense overall in the case, extraordinary expenses, attorney expenses, in a lump sum. Is that right?
That's correct. It's a lump sum broken down by type of provider. So attorneys, X amount, investigators, X amount.
Right.
Thank you. My question has been answered.
I just thought, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, however, of a situation where, and, you know, everything is history out of Linn County, where the court did grant a new trial in a co-defendant aggravated murder case, and that may be one where one would be concerned. But, again, this is limited not... This is limited only to the total amount. It doesn't even go as far as we currently do.
Right.
Okay.
I am I am cognizant of Representative Jensen's concerns about the language on the witness issue and want that addressed. I'm also cognizant that we need to move this bill forward because of time deadlines. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering on my concern if after the semicolon, available semicolon,
page two,
strike the semicolon and put or for cost considerations, so it would read contracting with expert out-of-state witnesses be to allow contracting with out-of-state expert witnesses only if in-state expert witnesses are not available or for cost considerations. If that would get us to...
Mm-hmm. Comments, committee?
Thank you.
Does that define it well enough that you feel like you can write your rules appropriately to address that issue? Representative Shetterly.
I was going to say, maybe the question would be, does it define it well enough to get it to the Senate? If it needs to be fixed, they can...
Well, no.
It sets forth what our intention is, and if there's some smithing that needs to be done, maybe better there once given the time constraints, as you've spoken to.
Yeah, that's a fair comment. Representative Poznanski.
I agree with that, and I think the other thing is whoever carries it on the floor can just put that into the record.
Yeah.
And then we'll let LC actually come up with the language that's going to do
it. And it's the chair's intention actually to carry this bill on the floor. I'm happy to make that part of the record. Representative Council Taylor, I'm going to make you a member before we're done here. Council Taylor.
I won't say anything. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I know it'll be a cut and pay. I'm sorry.
Hey, that's a good way to say
it. Make all the staff members. Non-voting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That's the language I will send down to Legislative Council's office or for cost considerations. They may want to tweak it, and if they do, I will send you a memo with the new language.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Then why don't we go ahead? The chair would move for suspension of the rules for the purposes of making a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2074-4 amendments. And the conceptual amendment would be to add after the word available on line 21, the words or for cost considerations before the semicolon. Is there any objection to that conceptual amendment? Okay, hearing none, the dash fours have been conceptually amended. The chair would move first the dash three amendments to House Bill 2074. Is there any discussion on the dash threes? Any objection? The threes are in. The chair would move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2074 as conceptually amended. Is there any discussion on the dash fours? Okay, the dash fours are in. And the chair would move House Bill 20.
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Oh. Yeah, and this originally, as it came out, had a subsequent to Ways and Means. Is there anything on this bill that you can foresee that would have a Ways and Means impact?
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. And I thought at the public hearing, at the public hearing on this bill in January, that it was not passed out because we wanted to check. We were surprised that there was the subsequent referral, and there is no fiscal.
Okay. All right. Then with that, the chair would move House Bill 2074 as amended by the dash threes and the conceptual dash four amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Okay, Patsy.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Poznanski.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2074 goes to the floor with a due pass. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Chair will now open a work session on House Bill 2638. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the dash five amendments, and this is a bill which we have completely removed the original bill, and we'll be substituting the dash five amendments. sets up a review process for appointment of counsel in the Judicial Review Board order, allows the Public Defense Service Commission to petition the Court of Appeals for court determination eligibility. We have Jim Nass and Peter Gartland here. Pete with the Public Defender's Office and Jim Nass with the courts. And this is something you may have remembered we had just a couple of weeks ago, and there was a provision in there concerning the appeals from the parole board and the process before the Court of Appeals, and that provision has been removed. What I understand is that they will be working these issues out among and between themselves to try to streamline the process without legislation. But they are here and ready and willing to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, why don't we have you both come up, if you would, just to give the committee a chance to determine whether they understand what's happening in the Dash 5s. And was it really a week ago, Jim? It seems like it was only yesterday.
I won't say, Mr. Chair.
All right. Let me just first see if there's questions. Does the committee have any questions about the Dash 5? You'll recall that this was the bill that we had Ms. Ray from parole. Who you guys want to put anything on the record? Peter, you want to start?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Gartland with the Office of Public Defense Services, and we were here about 6 days ago. And as Mr. Taylor has reported, this bill originally had two major parts. One was had to do with appointment of counsel. By statute, our office was appointed to represent parolees, and we wanted to make sure that the statute clearly specified that we would only represent parolees who were indigent, who qualified, and if we made the determination that someone was not qualified, they had an opportunity or a mechanism to challenge that by motioning the Court of Appeals for that determination. The other half of the bill we thought was not going to be controversial, but I was proved wrong. And Diane Ray was here, and she voiced her concerns, and the chair asked for a fiscal impact. And so after that hearing, after that work session, we decided with Jim and with management team in our office that we would remove that request, remove that amendment, and attempt to streamline the system, make it more cost efficient without any sort of statutory change. And essentially, so what's left is just the first part of the bill, and the first part of the bill essentially just says that if we determine that a parolee is not qualified for our services, is not indigent, that the parolee has an opportunity to challenge that determination by moving the Court of Appeals to review that determination. So as it stands now, I don't think it's controversial. I don't think anybody's going to say anything against this. This seems like a common sense, cost-effective, just a house-cleaning bill at this point.
Great. Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Nass, Appellate Legal Counsel. I concur with what Peter has said.
And Peter, I note that you're going to make this sort of the subject of a discussion over the interim on this motion practice issue that you brought to the committee, and you're going to work with the Department of Justice and the Court of Appeals, and I assume that Ms. Ray will be involved in that through her legal counsel, through the Department of Justice, in trying to address this issue. I'll just say now that we've lived with portions of this issue for all of last session and now part of this session, I'll just invite you to come in at some point during the interim and talk to the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee, assuming there will be such a thing. I've heard rumor there might not be joint committees or interim committees, but assuming that there are, in fact, interim committees, I think we'd be interested in an update on how this is going. And given that period of time, we might be able to devote a little more of our attention to fully understanding the impacts on the motion practice issue, and maybe you'll have it all resolved and you won't need any legislation.
Sure, that would be fine. Our hope is that given a little bit of time, perhaps we can work with the motion practice and reduce the number of motions required and perhaps reduce the page limit and reduce the number of hours involved with the motion practice and get to the same result, only just limiting the cost somewhat.
Okay. Are there questions for either Mr. Nass or Mr. Garland? Okay, thank you.
I do have one
question.
Representative
Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a person has been charged with something, with a crime, and they don't know that they, or they've been told that they have a right to an attorney if they can't afford one, how do they find out, I guess, about this so that they know what to appeal to the Court of Appeals, number one, if they're turned down? And number two is, doesn't it cost money to file an appeal with the Court of Appeals? So if they can't afford an attorney, who pays for their cost to appeal to the Court of Appeals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, this particular bill addresses only parolees. So it's people, inmates already in custody, who are challenging Board of Parole decisions about release or about the conditions of parole. So it doesn't really apply to people who are charged with crimes, right? And what would happen is, pursuant to this amendment, is once OPDS, once our office made a determination that someone didn't qualify, we would tell them and we would inform them about the procedure by which they can ask the Court of Appeals to review that determination. And we found that a lot of the parolees are actually fairly well versed in the matters of legal affairs and legal mechanisms, and given the instruction that they would get in our letter that declined to represent them, we would probably include a form, just sort of a one-page or two-page form, to allow them to file that pro se with the Court of Appeals, and then the Court of Appeals would make a determination. So they would be informed of their right, and that's in the statute or in the amendment.
Okay. Additional questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przonski.
I'd move, the dash fives into House Bill 2638.
Representative Przonski moves the dash fives into House Bill 2638. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection? The dash fives are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2638 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przonski moves House Bill 2638 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Call the roll, please.
There is a subsequent referral on this.
Oh, is there?
Oh, excuse me. Move to rescind. Sure. That's right. But that's to the original bill. And that was related to one half of traffic fines. If there's ever a bill we have before us that doesn't have a fiscal impact as amended, I'd say it'd be this one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it just cuts it out. So, Representative, thank you, Patsy, for that catch. Saves Representative Ackerman and I having to do our reconsideration shtick at the beginning of every meeting. Well, you want to amend your motion, Representative Przonski?
Yeah, I'll amend my motion to also recommend that we rescind the recommendation to send it to Ways and Means.
Representative Przonski moves that House Bill 2638 be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that we rescind the referral, the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion? All right, now call the roll, Patsy.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2638 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Przonski, you want to carry it?
Sure.
All right. All right, we'll open a work session on House Bill 3119. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3119 comes to you from Representative Butler, who was up here earlier but told me that he had to be downstairs in his subcommittee meeting because we're doing the Department of Corrections budget. But he was interested in having the bill passed out and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. The bill allows court to place a defendant who is put on probation for misdemeanor under the court's supervision, allows court to order defendant to pay a fee to offset the court's supervising costs, establishes court's
court-supervised probation fund appropriates money in the fund to the judicial department. You will notice on line 9, page 1 of the bill, the only page of the bill, there's a blank as it relates to the amount of the fee. I believe the reason for this is that in many rural counties that they sometimes do not have a sufficient enough probation department, and they will oftentimes the judge will put someone under court supervision and bring them back from time to time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pozanski.
And there's a lot of cases that are disposed in this way that people are, when they plead out, they are not given a referral to the P&P, but are basically just put on court probation. That usually just means self-reporting from that individual if they fail to comply with whatever orders are in the judgment of conviction. And, I mean, it seems like, are we now going to say there's going to be some fee assessed? And if so, is this a one-time fee or a month? It says monthly fee.
Here's what I'm going to read this. Representative Butler gave me a copy of an email that he received. Is it Judge Pratt out in that part of the country? I'm not familiar with Judge Pratt. But this is what he says, and I'll just read this so you guys can then we can talk about it. There are hundreds of thousands of criminal cases, primarily misdemeanor cases, where conditions of probation are imposed each year in this state. In most cases, those people are not accepted for formal probation, so they are placed on bench probation and monitored by the court staff. The court system has never been funded for this purpose, and the tracking responsibility has been placed with judicial assistants or other court staff in addition to other responsibilities. With the reduction in funding of the judicial department because of budget cuts, the ability of the courts to monitor people on bench probation has further diminished or disappeared in many courts. I'll make a parenthetical. On Friday, I spent a fair amount of time in my in-district day meeting with about a half a dozen judges in my court in Washington County who will confirm that statement to be true, given their current situation, they are being able, because it's not the judges, it's mostly the court staff that are doing these bench probations. And with the staffing reductions and the budget cuts to the court, they're just not able to keep up on the bench probation. So, and my parenthetical, and begin again with Judge Pratt's email, a probation automatically expires and the defendants are free of any further obligation even if they have not met all the terms of probation, unless there is a motion in order to show cause to deal with the probation violations before the probation expiration date. Typical conditions are payment of financial obligations, including restitution, drug and alcohol treatment, batterers, intervention programs, and anger management programs. Without the staff to monitor these bench probations, the probations will expire, and defendants will be released from probation without having met their obligations as ordered by the court. The fee charge for bench probation would be far less than the fee for supervised probation, open parent, 25 to 35 per month, close parent, and would require the defendant to pay for some of the costs that the court system incurs in monitoring their performance on probation, costs that are incurred because of their criminal conduct period. Hope this helps. Signed, Judge Pratt. So that's the theory behind it, is that you capture with a small monthly bench probation fee the money that would then be used to fund the court staff who would actually be responsible for trying to monitor and keep up. And it really is. I mean, this isn't people picking up the phone and calling every night and seeing if you're home at 11 o'clock and you didn't go to the bar. It's checking to see on the record before the expiration of the probation deadline, did you pay your fine? Did they get the form back that said that you actually participated in treatment? I mean, it's really, for the most part, a fairly mechanical kind of probation. And then if not, they can, if they violated, they can issue a warrant or extend or a show cause hearing or any number of other things. So that's the issue. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens if they don't pay it?
Well, in the real world, pre-budget crisis and court disassemblance, things would happen. You'd get pulled back in and you'd potentially, you know, if it was a significant enough failure and you couldn't explain to the judge why the failure mattered, you could probably get yanked into the system. You could probably spend some time in the county lockup or any number of other alternatives. Today, realistically...
That's my question.
Realistically today, I could probably bring Kelly Sky up to tell us what really happens today, or Ann Christian, both. You both want to come up? Why don't you come up and tell them what really happens today? I mean, when somebody's on a bench probation like this and they fail to pay their financial obligation for a crime that we're currently not even, you know, that we're not really prosecuting given the current budget restriction, and then they don't pay their violation fee or their bench probation fee, and assuming you have a court staff that even finds out that it hasn't been paid before the bench probation expires, what happens to that person, Kelly?
Well, Representative Williams, or Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, that varies widely based on the judge who's supervising. There are some judges who have their staff right on top of these probations and very routinely bring people in for failing to pay their financial obligations. In Multnomah County, we actually do have a program very similar to this, and I'm not sure of the statutory basis for it. I had never thought it through until I saw this bill, but we have what's called an enhanced bench probation, which is supervised by the court coordinator, who's a person who isn't actually a judicial assistant. It's his job to supervise these probations, and they charge $15 a month supervision fee. And so that person is actually able to generate the motions and orders for show cause to bring people in for probation violations. And those enhanced bench probations do get enforced. But it generally varies widely based on the judge, because many judges believe that if someone is indigent and they haven't paid a they never believe this on restitution, but if they haven't paid something like a supervision fee, that they're not willing to spend the resources if they've done everything else on their probation. There are other judges who feel that any minor violation whatsoever is enough to bring the person in. So I think it really varies widely based on the judge.
Mr. Chair and Christian, Judicial Department, for the record, to answer directly the question as far as what would happen today, an individual who is alleged to have violated their probation, so long as it wasn't a serious violent offender type of probation, which is not what we're talking about in this bill, that individual would appear in court, and if the individual could not hire a lawyer, they would be told to come back sometime in the new biennium. Now, I know from serving on the Chief Justice's Budget Reduction Advisory Committee that this is not a way to run a judicial system, and the Judicial Department is interested in the next biennium of trying to ensure there are adequate funds so that we don't have a repeat of what our current court operations and indigent defense budget crises are. And I think this House Bill 3119 is an excellent vehicle. Judge Pratt is one with many wonderful ideas, and I personally think this is a good idea. It does depend a lot with the judge. I can go back almost 20 years ago to a judge in Multnomah County who had his judicial assistant really being a formal supervised probationer, and this individual's office probably had over 1,000 case files. And until this idea was raised by Representative Butler and Judge Pratt, the courts have had to deal with what is a significant caseload of PDs. The final thing I would say is, as we're in this current budget crisis, it's interesting the things we're learning, I guess, and what I'm hearing of most concern from judges with regard to public safety is it is indeed the probation violations in many cases where the judges are most alarmed about the fact that they cannot appoint counsel, because after all, these are people who have already been convicted and who are allegedly not complying with the terms of their probation. So we all hope that through vehicles like this and other changes in our public safety system, that 2003-05 will put us in a position where the courts and public defense can provide services.
Representative Williams, if I may, from OCDLA's perspective, we thought that expanding this bill might actually be a good idea in the cases of certain non-person felonies. Currently, by statute, any guidelines case, a felony guidelines case, is required to be sentenced to formal probation. A number of those people are simply put on what's called case bank, and they call a 1-900 number once a month and push certain buttons, and they get a $25 charge on their phone bill for having made this phone call, and that's the only thing that they do as a, to report to formal probation. And there are many judges who would be willing to supervise felonies, I'm assuming if they were able to recoup the cost for doing that. And so that was one suggestion that we had, was that you expand it to, at the discretion of the judge, to allow them to place non-person felonies on bench probation instead of formal probation.
All right, committee. Thoughts, Representative Prasansky?
I think the one thing that we want to keep in mind, and I know we probably will not be the ones that's going to be placing what that amount is, but any amount that we put in here, and we're using the $25, figuring that probations in my court run anywhere from 12 to 24 months. Mm-hmm. So for 12 months, you're looking at $300 cost. We had someone in for a shoplifting, which is a Class A misdemeanor. Maximum penalty is $5,000 or up to 1 year in jail. If it's their first conviction, I would probably be asking for somewhere between, depending on the dollar amount and the situation, anywhere from $300 to $500 in a fine. What you're going to probably see is the judge is going to take in consideration, one, what the fine amount is going to be based on the other type of assessments, and potentially waiving some of the assessments that actually would be paid to the state to get the money for the court, because they're going to take care of making sure they get their probation fees to cover their cost. And then I think you're just going to see this maneuvering, because there's that question always, is the ability to pay. And if you have people who are indigent that are represented by counsel, not always do they pay the full amount that would be assessed because of their inability to pay. And so I think that this is a interesting concept, and I have no objection to going forward, but we need to realize it's going to have impacts at other parts as to where we may think we may be getting the same amount of revenue coming to the state for fines or for unitary assessments. That probably is not the case.
Let me just say that I've been working closely, as Ann knows, because she's been in most of these meetings with Representative Patridge, and the folks, the DAs, the judges, the indigent defense folks, and others, as we're sort of trying to assess how best to fashion a structure that's going to get us through this next biennium and deal with sort of the bubble that we're in right now. And we're making, I think, some progress with some ideas. I view this as one more potential tool mm-hmm. in the toolbox that Ways and Means, as we structure this thing, can have some input on. Several of those tools, I'll just let you committee know, eventually are going to be back to us. There are a number of these discussions that are going to require some policy involvement before to give Ways and Means, once we've sort of figured out the budget side, the flexibility they need to do some of these things at the court level and at the district attorney level, and they're not going to be easy. This one seems to me like a fairly easy one to send down and have as a vehicle for, you know, fitting into this mix if, in fact, that ends up being one of the things we want to do. And I understand your suggestion, Kelly, and, again, I think that's an amendment that if we were inclined to expand it to that level for the cost purposes of dealing with the nonviolent category, the non-person category, that's, again, a choice that I think we could make potentially when we evaluate the whole picture in the Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prasansky.
You ready for a motion?
Sure.
Move House Bill 3119. I guess this is going to go just to Ways and Means, right? No recommendation. Or did you want to recommend
it? I want to recommend it.
We can recommend it.
Okay.
Yeah.
With the due
it does have subsequent
right.
Ways and
right. And that's where we're going to send it. Okay. So Representative Prasansky moves 3119 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is Representative Shetterly.
I just wanted to make sure, Mr. Chair, did the amendments that eliminate the Portland Development Commission get in this bill?
Yeah, they were. We adopted them just a few
good.
Moments ago.
Okay, I wanted to make sure we'd take
okay.
care of it.
Good.
Oh,
Chip.
Chip Lazenby.
Oh, hi, Chip. Your timing was impeccable. Well, you know that Representative Shetterly and I always appreciate it when you're here to be the butt of one of his jokes. I just want you to. All right. So the motion is to move this bill to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Jensen.
I just wondered if this is going to become known as the revenue shift bill from Representative Brzezinski's discussion that he had. If we're just if we can nickname it something here before we move.
Well, I hope not. Because anything that has a shift associated with it these days just seems like it's got a bad connotation. But he is right. I mean, there is a balance on these things. The more you try to get on the front end like that, the less you pick up, for example, in the criminal fines and assessment account. And you have to recognize that, you know, there's. It's the old saying, Representative Jensen, there is no free money in this process. If you're getting some on one part, you're taking it out of somewhere else.
And if we could get more judges, if I might, Mr. Chairman, who have this 1,000-person caseload that they're managing, we could probably save some money off of the probation officers that we have out there.
Oh, well, I don't even know I want to walk into that one, Representative. Representative Barker, did you have a comment?
I hope we're sending this out with due pass.
Yeah, it was, with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Wood?
Aye. 3119 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, and we'll do our last work session on 3193. Council.
Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3193 reclassifies certain crimes against animals to double the maximum fine. You have the -3 amendments that came from Representative Avakian today, and they are before you. And so is Representative Avakian.
Both he and his amendments. Representative Avakian.
Rather than wrangling, Mr. Chair, with the definition of what, in the presence of means, I thought it would be a good idea to just create a new cause of action for the animals that were witness to this type of emotional disturbance. And so you have the -3 amendments before you. No. -3 simply changes.
For the record, he's only kidding.
Yes, right, thank you, Mr. Good. Chair. The -3 amendments simply change the language from in the presence of to, and the abuse occurs on the premises as defined in ORS 164.205, where there are 8 or more animals, including the victim. Which I think should dispel some of the concerns we had about the state of mind of the animals that might be witnessing the abuse.
And what's the definition of 164.205? Are you?
That's the definition that's out of the criminal code for criminal trespass.
Okay.
And I just suggested that be the one that we use.
All right. So it's a well-used definition then.
Yes, and I would appreciate Representative Brzezinski's direction to that statute.
She's for criminal trespass into burglary.
All right. Is there discussion? Right. Questions for Representative Brzezinski? Representative Anderson.
We're talking about animal neglect one having a fine of $200,000.
Yes.
Has that been changed, or aggravated animal abuse one $200,000?
Well, let me look. Are you looking to the amendments that I just gave you?
This summer. No.
No, this was on the original bill.
I don't.
Has that been changed?
No.
No.
Measure.
The $200,000 penalty does not apply to the neglect statute. It applies to the animal abuse in the first degree section, which is the most severe animal abuse statute.
So it would be on on page 2, section 4, section 3, sub 4. If a person commits the crime of aggravated animal abuse in the first degree as part of a single criminal episode that involves 8 or more animals, with each animal being subjected to one or more crimes described in the sections, aggravated animal abuse in the first degree is an unclassified felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 5 years and a fine of $200,000 or both. And is that amended?
That's already law.
It's only amended with regard to the definition of premises, as we discussed.
Okay. So it's the premises definition that gets changed.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Just for the record, premises as it's defined in 164.205 reads, premises includes any building and any real property, whether privately or publicly owned. And the reason Representative Ockin and I chose this one is because the privately or publicly does not require the individual who's being charged to actually have ownership of it. And so it could be, the abuse could occur in any of those settings, and we wouldn't have to be worrying about, because at one point it looked like we were contemplating whether or not there's going to have to be some type of ownership or leasehold on the property with the suspect.
Not sure that answers my question in my mind.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, I have. What does the $200,000 refer to in terms of Representative Avakian's amendments and all?
I think, Representative, it doesn't change. It only is animal aggravated, so it's aggravated animal abuse in the first degree as part of a single criminal episode that involves eight or more animals. So you have to have it aggravated animal abuse. There's got to be a single episode that involves eight or more animals, with each of those, or with one or more of those animals being subject to one or more of crimes describing what constitutes aggravated animal abuse. And then it's an unclassified felony punishable by imprisonment of not more than 5 years or a fine of $200,000 for both. So it's only the highest level where it's included eight or more animals is sort of the predicate. Am I right about that, Brad?
It's, I guess, technically the two highest levels, animal abuse and aggravated animal abuse, which are both the felony violations.
Could you give me an example of where this might, what kind of abuse? Is it starvation, essentially?
Well, the definition that is applied is when it is done maliciously or with torture, intentionally acting with depravity of mind and reckless and wanton disregard of life. I suppose there could be a situation where you were not feeding or hydrating the animal. Generally, those come under the neglect statute, which would have a much lower penalty. But I suppose if somebody was doing it with wanton disregard with life and maliciously, it could fall within this section.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Anderson?
And that is already in the law. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Excuse me for being slow, but I don't see that already in the law. And I'm looking at 157.322.
I think Representative Anderson meant already in the bill.
It's
in the printed bill, but it is a change to the current law.
That's right.
But it's not in the dash three amendments. The dash three amendments are included.
If I may, Mr. Chair, in addition to that, the only thing that I am changing from the current law are the monetary penalties.
Right.
The standards for abuse and neglect and the criminal, the jail terms, are all in the existing law and have not been changed. Not just in the existing bill, but the existing law.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under RS 161.625, fines for felonies, a sentence to pay a fine for felony shall be sentenced to pay an amount fixed by court not exceeding, for an A felony, $300,000, for a B felony, not exceeding $200,000, for a C felony, not exceeding $100,000. So what this does for a C felony of abuse of an animal, it doubles the fine from $100,000 to
$200,000. Not to exceed.
Not to exceed,
excuse
that's
me.
Right.
But
I mean, a judge could issue a dollar fine, or he could issue a $200,000 fine. It's the discretion of the judge.
And Representative Jensen, you'll remember that the early discussion about this was to not have it be an increase to the anything other than the fiscal penalty, in part to keep the cost ultimately down in the system, but also because there are people who have sort of turned this in, you know, this hoarding of these animals in these conditions for a money-making venture, and the increased financial penalties would give leverage to the court in being able to impact those individuals without having a negative impact on the rest of the criminal justice system.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
And I don't mean to be picky on this, but I don't see any not to exceed in the language in the bill that we have. I see a direct statement, a fine of $200,000. There's no discretion as far as the judge is concerned, if I read this correctly.
At least in the summary.
Okay, on line 42, page 2, or...
throughout the bill. Good catch.
Line 23, page 2.
Yeah, it's a hammer, isn't it?
That'd be conceptual amendment to stuff.
Yeah.
You could do that.
Not
to exceed.
Not to exceed.
Throughout the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. It's five, not more than 5 years, and also a fine of.
And, or.
Hey, Mr. Chair, if I can, it's always, throughout the statutes, and this is just something that bothers me, but it does state it in the disjunctive, right. But then it says, or both. You'll find that everywhere. So that's common drafting.
Yeah. So, assume we wanted to make this this change conceptually, we would want to word it unclassified misdemeanor, for example, I'm just looking at line 15 on page 2, punishable by imprisonment for not more than 1 year, a fine, insert not to exceed, $10,000 or both. Is that how you'd word it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I've got them.
Okay. Brad, you got a comment on that? Representative Avakian, I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think that's fine. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
I'm sorry. I just had one question.
Yeah.
And at least acknowledge what we're doing here, and that is in the dash threes, where we refer to eight or more animals, including the victim. I don't think this is at least the first foray, isn't that, into statute recognizing an animal as a victim for the purpose of animal abuse. I'm not arguing with it necessarily. I want to point it out anyway, so at least we're not doing it unawares. I don't know that we recognize. So far, animals are treated pretty much as property, and this regards animal as a victim of abuse. And again, I'm not arguing with it, but so we know what we're doing if anybody asks us someday.
But Mr. Chair.
Do they get victim's assistance? Yeah.
Oh, God, you guys.
Two friskies in a bowl.
And I just want to remind the representative from Dallas that I think his was the first bill that actually acknowledged the animal's personhood for purposes of probate and estate protective proceedings in your cat trust bill. Representative Prosansky.
Mr. Chair, when Representative Avakian and I spoke about this, I'm not sure if LC considered, but one of the suggestions that we had made was to be the victim animal, adding the word animal after the word victim to identify that it was an animal. But I guess in the wisdom of the drafters, they decided to leave it as a victim.
They had a case up in Washington County where somebody's animal was shot, and people were able to sue over that for, like, it was a member of the family, emotional distress kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that shifted.
There's a point when this bill is going to be a dog, okay?
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in direction of the committee. I think we could make the conceptual amendments to the bill to get to the issue of the not exceeding parts in the fine if the committee were disposed to move forward with the bill. I'm not terribly troubled with, for purposes of this statute, you know, using the language victim. That doesn't trouble me personally, but it might some.
It can be fixed on the Senate side if they want to make another change.
Paul, what did you think? I'm thinking of Max the dog. Victim.
Yeah. If it was your dog, you'd think he was a
campaign
victim.
Dog. You're right. That's my campaign.
Mr. Chair?
He is victim.
Yeah, Representative McPherson. What do the Scottish think about it?
Well, actually, I'm going to draw on my dairying roots here, in which we did what I realize now were unspeakable things to our critters during the normal course of running that operation. But despite that history, I think that when you characterize an offense as animal abuse, there is a victim, and the victim is the animal. And so I'm not troubled by the idea that we would refer to them as a victim, and I'm prepared to proceed on that basis.
All right, I'll take that as a motion by Representative McPherson to dash three amendments into House Bill 3193, considering we've only got 3 minutes to wrap this up, committee. Is there any? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Are we going to amend the dash threes with the?
It'll be the.
We'll go back in and do a conceptual on the bill. So the dash threes, any objection? They're in the bill. And then I'm going to let Representative Shetterly craft the motion on the not to exceed, because you said you'd got them all marked.
I've got them marked, too.
I've got them either way.
Either way.
All right. Are you ready? All right. Go ahead, Representative Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to amend House Bill 3193 as amended conceptually to have the term not to exceed.
Mr. Chair. I'm looking. Not exceeding is the statutory language.
Not exceeding?
Yeah.
Not exceeding, insert it on, I'm going to just go through the following lines. Page 1, line 16. Page 2, line 16. Page 2, line 23. Page 2, line 42. Page 3, line 9. Page 3, line 22. Page 3, line 33. And page 4, line 2.
And Representative Brzezinski, did you pick up also page 2, line 23?
I did.
Yeah.
Okay. And in front of the numerical number and deleting, not exceed, I guess of. The word of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On each of those lines.
On each of those lines. Okay. All right.
Not to exceed.
Bill, did you pop in for a purpose on this bill?
Place to rest.
Place to rest.
All right.
Not exceed.
Because I'm not sure this bill could get any more wacky.
Oh, he's under arrest.
That's okay. We only have a couple minutes.
Yeah, right. All right. That's the conceptual amendments to the amended version of 3193 made by Representative Brzezinski. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The bill is conceptually amended and amended by the dash three amendments. Representative Brzezinski?
Move House Bill 3193 as amended by the committee, including the conceptuals, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3193 as amended, including the conceptual amendments to the bill, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Representative Ackerman.
Do we have any fiscal on this since we're enhancing crimes?
Well, we don't. We don't, because it's only enhancing the financial penalty.
The penalty phase.
Yeah, this is our second set of the plus crimes. You know, like we had the Pioneer one that went to the
right.
Okay.
A Class A misdemeanor.
Right. This is the C plus.
C plus.
This is the C plus bill. All right. Call the roll, Patsy.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Prozanski.
Yes.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. 3193 is amended and conceptually amended. It goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Avakian will carry his bill on the floor.
It will be a good time.
Krasowski's begging from the floor. Thank you for your good
work. All right, we are adjourned. Get rid-